Monday, September 26th, a day when I get to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, is in part a lost day for me. Lyndon did in fact manage to sleep until after 8:30, very good for him, and I stumbled into my room, but could not go back to sleep. I simply find myself needing more sleep, more rest, than I have in years past. I am resentful, but cannot change it. I worked in desultory fashion at my desk. Talked with Patsy about plans for her future. She can work, but in a limited fashion, not after 5 o'clock, not easily on Saturdays. Back on my diet, I had no breakfast and scrambled egg and half a piece of toast and a little bacon and Sanka for lunch, and then lay down to try to take a nap. Lyndon came over at 3:20 for his lunch. He looked weary, and I sat with him, searching for something cheerful to talk about, until I left for Jean-Louise and a complete redo. After my busy week of salt spray and riding in open cars and 16-hour working days always on public view, and last a long swim in the lake on Sunday, I took with me the German background to read and left instructions with Patsy to meet and put in their rooms our house guests, Jay Taylor, the Tom Frost, and the Max Brooks, who I'd chatted with them just before I left. Back at the White House, I greeted the other house guests over the telephone, dressed while Bess briefed me on seating arrangements. Linda and I met fully dressed, she in her lovely golden beaded dress, and me in my gold brocade that was a gift for my Yukon. There's always that tense moment before a state dinner, when Lyndon has not yet come over to dress, and the clock ticks on to about 8:15, and suddenly he comes, in 5 minutes he's ready, and then he's saying, Bess, I thought you told me the Prime Minister, or the King, or whatever it is, was supposed to be here at 8:10. This time, we were down at the North Portico to greet the Chancellor and Mrs. Earhart, under a gray and drizzling sky, at just 8:01. This is the Chancellor's third visit, but it's the first time that he's brought his wife. She was a tall, stately woman, as German as Brunhilde, spoke little English. It's very pleasant. I kept on hearing the word Wunderbar dropped. We went upstairs with rather a large group, her daughter and son-in-law, the Klotzes, the Russ and Goldbergs and McNamaras, and of course the McGees and the Symingtons, and Ambassador Napstein without his wife, she was back in Germany, and several of those we'd known from past visits, but this time with their wives, Dr. and Mrs. Gerhard Schrader, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Ludger Vestrick, and the Minister of Defense, Mr. von Hassel, and his wife. I was delighted to see Cecile McGee, and she was all light and laughter, very much at home in this world. She'd been having a marvelous time at Farmer's Delight with children and grandchildren. Always before state dinner, I come into the yellow room ahead of time and look at the gifts. This time I had not done so. Homework always pays. One should brief oneself, learn as much as possible. Our gifts to the visitor are always displayed on the desk, theirs on a table close to the fireplace. I walked up to the usual spot. There was the usual photograph, a tray engraved with a seal, a Navajo rug, a book of pictures called This America. The text has excerpts from Lyndon's speeches. And then on the left, two items I couldn't place. A tiny Minox camera, handsomely covered in leather, and two porcelain peacocks. I stumbled, for once I was glad of the language barrier. I looked at the other table. There was nothing on it. Somewhat belatedly, I realized they were their presents to us. And I went into high gear on how delighted I would be to have these porcelain peacocks join the other handsome birds that the Chancellor had given us on his other visit to the ranch. We displayed them on the piano at the ranch and on top of a bookcase. And I, being an amateur photographer, was certain to borrow the little Minox, which was Lyndon's present. It was an uncomfortable moment. The moral is, learn ahead. The guards came in and removed the colors, and we marched down the hall to the unfitting music of some modern staccato brassy composition. I always wonder about the behind-the-scenes working, the communications that tells the leader of the Marine Band the moment at which we leave the yellow room and start for the staircase so that he can break in to hail to the chief at the precisely right moment. 9/10 of the time, it is smooth and velvet working. Sometimes the gears grind just a little. We waited a moment at mid-stairs. Then came the stirring notes. I hailed the chief, and down we went, Lyndon escorting Mrs. Earhart, and I on the arm of the Chancellor. The guests were the usual potpourri, particular accent on German interests. From the cabinet, the Fowlers, the McNamaras, the Katzenbachs. From the court, the Fortises. From the Senate, Senator Williams of Delaware, and the Dirksons, he still on crutches. Small, genial Governor Tolls of Maryland, without his lovely wife, and a very handsome young couple. To my amazement, they were Democrats. Governor and Mrs. Guy of North Dakota. There was a sizable contingent from the House, among them the Ed Edmondsons of Oklahoma. I believe he's a young comer, and he's certainly a great friend to the beautification conservation measures, and the John Slacks that we've met on our trip to West Virginia. Among old friends were General and Mrs. Lucius Clay. I remember when we'd complimented him once very highly to Dick Nixon. He'd said, "Now, Mr. President, don't take everybody away from us. We've just gotten him to take the post as money raiser for the Republican Party." And the Bob Andersons of Eisenhower's cabinet, and long before that, our friends in Texas. And the Dick Berlins, funny, still looking just like her name, friendly, warm, blonde, delicious. And the Gussie Bushes, I ask about the number of children, and they are now 7. Labor was represented by the veteran George Meany, on his cane, and Mrs. Meany, and the Joe Keenans. In the world of education, by Dr. James Perkins of Cornell, his gay, vivacious wife. I believe that's part of the requisites of being the wife of a college president, sat at our table. And by Dr. and Mrs. Meredith Wilson of the University of Minnesota, and the George Kistiakovskis of Harvard. From government, there were the Jim Webbs, the George Balls, his last of many dinners as the Undersecretary of State, and the Dean Achesons. What an aristocratic pair they are. And there were 2 astronauts, the Charles Conrads and the Richard Gordons. They always cause a ripple of excitement in a crowd, the astronauts. And a sprinkling of movie stars to add brilliance to the evening. Arlene Dahl and her husband Alexis Lachine, lovely quiet brunette Merle Oberon, and her Italian-Mexican husband Bruno Pagliai. They invited Linda to their home down in Acapulco. And actress Barbara Rush, and George Hamilton was there as Linda's date. And later, when the newspaper women gathered around him, just like the chickens do when the farmer throws out corn, I was annoyed because tonight is to be a showcase for Germany and not for young romance. And there were other Texas guests besides our house guests. Dr. and Mrs. John Gwynn, the president of Texas Women's University. I'd last seen him as we walked between the avenues of redbuds on the campus at Denton, for me to receive an honorary degree. And Ernest Kurth, Jr., whose father had been our great friend, he'd given Linda Bird a bond every birthday from the time she was born until he died when she was about 18. And the attractive young Wales Maddens of Amarillo. And that veteran Democrat, C.T. McLaughlin, Mr. Mac, of the Diamond M. Ranch at Snyder, and his wife. And the Arthur Stalings from Fredericksburg. I am sure we had no more interested guests than they. I only regret that the Petches couldn't come, too. We'd ask the Goldbergs' daughter. I love including the children of our good friends, because I know how much it means to me when ours are included. A scattering of names, well-known and not known, in profession and business and the arts. Edward Durrell Stone, Drew Pearson, John McCloy. Some 173 guests in all, many of whom stopped to speak a few words in German to the Chancellor, so that it was a long line, and 9 o'clock, when the 4 of us departed, Lyndon with Mrs. Earhart for the main dining room, and me with the Chancellor for the blue room. He had Dorothy Goldberg on his other side, good insurance that the conversation does not lag, and then handsome General Taylor, and then Mrs. Sarnoff. And I delighted in telling her how much I admired her husband, an optimist about man and his future. We had to have a translator. It does make it difficult. I talked with the Chancellor about his glass house, his official residence, about the River Ruhr, which I'm told is one of the cleanest rivers in the world, running right through the industrial districts, a great achievement of mankind. I just wonder how they get them to pay the taxes cheerfully. And about the little tiny gardens of flowers and vegetables that residents of high-rise public housing units have at the outskirts of town and turn into bright jewels with their devoted work. Unfortunately, I was talking at too high a level. The Chancellor and the Minister of Foreign Affairs could not really explain them to me.